That promise was not given to the Jew. That's birthright promise. Now, Jews may have been counting stars and sand and laying that trip on their old lady for years, but it's still not their responsibility. Is that clear? We've been over it and over it and over it, but why is it people have grown up in the church? Nobody's told them that. The Jew never got the birthright. Judah got the scepter and the lawmaking right. Joseph got all the rest. Ephraim, his younger son, being given the birthright preeminence. So Hosea very accurately says, it's the house of Israel, the Ephraimites, the 10-tribe kingdom dominated by the house of Ephraim, that will be scattered, become known as not God's people, not having God's mercy, but nevertheless will become so numerous they'll be like the sand of the sea and the stars of the heavens. That means you'll never find the lost tribes, a little bitty group gathered around a tree somewhere or an oasis. They must be a major population group in the world. Or God's a liar. Now, how many major population groups are there in the world? There's the blacks. There's the Slavs. There's the Chinese. There's the Indians. Not American. Indian. You've got to find an identifiable, monstrously large group of people. Inductive reasoning, therefore, says God's a liar, or the lost tribes represent one of the major population groups identifiable in the world today. Now, if that's not true, God's a liar. Is that clear? There must be such a powerful nation, Genesis 49 says, Ephraim and Manasseh together, in combination, Ephraim and Manasseh, the sons of Joseph, must become such a powerful nation that they will push other nations to the end of the world. That means they're not only numerous, they must be a powerful nation pushing other nations to the end of the world. Who's done that? I mean, you find the big bunch first, but it being big isn't enough. There's got to be a powerful nation. So powerful, no weapon formed against them will prosper. They will never be destroyed in a major war. So it's ipso facto. They must become a great empire and be around somewhere today, still undefeated. You know, the more I do this, the more I realize how stupid most of the church is. This is as obvious as the sun coming up in the morning. Furthermore, they must possess the gates of their enemies. Well, who does that? Who has become an empire never defeated? And that same empire representing a major population group in the world, and they possess the gates of their enemies. And this is the most amazing one. What Hosea said. that in the place that they're scattered to, where they will become so numerous they're analogous to the stars and to sand, having lost their connection in appearance with God, appearing not God's people, the result of scattering, appearing not having God's mercy, nevertheless, in that very place that they're scattered to, where they've become so numerous they're like stars and sand, where they've become a nation, powerful, they will become known as the sons of God. Doesn't say they'll become known as Israel. They'll become known as the sons of God. A Christian nation. Not a heathen nation. Not Buddhist. Not Vedanta. Not headhunters. Though that was in their heritage. They'll become known as the sons of God. Isn't that what Christians call themselves? If I didn't know anything else, I could find the lost tribes. Look for a giant population group that have become a major nation that became an empire so strong it pushes other nations to the ends of the globe. That's a colonializing picture. Never suffering annihilation and defeat and becoming known as the sons of God, not worshipers of Jehovah, sons of God. I could find the lost tribes. Well, now, they were settled south of the Caspian Sea. 2,520 years had to go by before you could discover them. Carried into bondage, the key date is 721 B.C. Let's take just great leaps. 700 years B.C., from 2520 is how much? Leaves how much? Huh? How much? Somebody say it loud and enunciate. 1820? 1820's left, right? Now, 721 B.C. happened to be the date that the capital city, Samaria, fell. But they were carried away into bondage in progressive stages for a period of about 70 years previous. The first tribes were to be carried into bondage included the half-tribe of Manasseh that had its territory on the east side of Jordan. In fact, the period of their captivity and the starting of the 2,520 years, seven times persecution number, began 50 to 70 years earlier. In short, the 2520, if we take 50 years as a good round figure, is somewhere around 1770 A.D. for Manasseh. I can tell you, the 2520 years from the carrying away of the half-tribe of Manasseh east of Jordan, 2520 years will bring you exactly to the Battle of Yorktown that began the firm breakaway of the United States from the British Empire. Now, just assume for a moment. I mean, from the carrying away of the half-tribe of Manasseh, you better start looking for significant events that identify Manasseh 2,520 years later. And the Battle of Yorktown ain't bad. If Manasseh could be the United States. Now, they were carried into bondage, and we didn't really begin to have the tools to discover the lost tribes until the end of the 1700s, the turn of the century that moved into the 1800s. The good that came out of Napoleon's attempt to copy Alexander the Great and his venture into Egypt, they found the Rosetta Stone with three languages simultaneously saying the same thing, which became the basis of finally breaking the hieroglyphics and discovering it was an alphabet, not just primitive picture writing. Then comes Botta and Lollard and Rawlinson and the digs in and around the lower reaches of the Tigris and Euphrates River. The breaking of the cuneiform writing and the discovery of what name these tribes went under. It took the Behistun rock to tell us that they were called Saki or Sakasuni by the Persians, Isaac's sons, because the I was dropped, a vowel, Saki's sons. It took the digs at Nineveh to uncover that the Assyrians called them Beit Qumri, after the sixth king of Israel, Umri, because Umri transferred the capital to Samaria, and Samaria was the final breakdown in the capturing of the northern kingdom. They were called Beit Qumri by the Assyrians, House of Qumri. They were never called Israel. They were called Qumri. They became part of that band of nomads called Scythians or Scouts, from the Hebrew word Scout. Feast of Scouts is a feast of tabernacles, temporary dwelling spaces. Nobody knew that until the first half of the 1800s, when archaeology began to bud and become a science, and we discovered their name. Beginning with the 1800s, mid-1800s, you could trace the history of the Scouts, the Saki, the Kimri, and we discover they weren't lost. Darius records that within 50 years they became mercenaries along the border. Instead of being a buffer between the Iranians, the Medes, and the Assyrians, they became mercenaries helping the Medes break the back of the Assyrians. And breaking the back of the Assyrians created the vacuum into which the Babylonian Empire moved. It would have become instantly the Median Empire, except that Darius, by then around the northern shores of the Persian Gulf, had so amalgamated the Persians into a strength that he was busy attacking the flank of the Medes and conquered them to weld them into the Medo-Persian Empire that ultimately would conquer the Babylonian Empire. In between the Assyrian and the Medo-Persian Empire, the Babylonian Empire rose up into the vacuum, because the Medes, with the Beit Qumri, or the resettled Israelites as mercenaries, broke the back of the Assyrians. As the Medes then had to turn and fight the Persians on their southern flank, and the Babylonians rose in strength, which included the ability to conquer 100 years later and take into bondage the house of Judah, the Israelites became marauding bands of not just mercenaries, but wandering Scythians themselves. A band of them pierced all across Armenia, across the Turkish peninsula, across the Dardanelles, to swing up into Thrace and become most of the tribes of Thrace in the Macedonian area, worshiping, if you will, a god in Moses' image. You who know the Thracians. Now, you don't get all the attention. You know what? I took my staff with me on vacation, key staff members. I figured Joseph Shackelford, my chief engineer, and his wife, after what they'd been through, and Larry Dudley and his wife, after what they'd been through in the trial of the recent weeks that resulted in innocence and victory and truth, deserved rest. And I can hardly spare my chief engineer either, so I decided I'd try to kill all the birds with one stone. I took Christine. Naturally, she goes where I go. And she directs. And she needed rest. I took Mike Rodriguez, the quiet one over there, who probably, second to me, puts in more hours. I'd say Joe Shack comes close, but I think Mike puts in more hours than anybody on my staff. He's the quiet hands and feet that have to be available all the time. His wife's about to have a second baby, and Joe's wife's about to have a baby, and they'll never have a vacation for 20 years now. So all those things weighed in upon me. And I took Mark Travis and his wife because I figured we Israelites needed a Jew in the crowd. And we went up to my parents' place at Lake Almanor. Now, Mike was funny. He thought when we went up there we had only one day. I have never seen anybody attack play in my life like Mike did. It was as though he had to cram 10 years into one day. The lake was at least a foot lower at the end of the day. He must have swallowed that much learning how to ride a jet ski. And they were all so mad because Christine could just step off a dock onto a jet ski and just zoom out like, you know, it was just born for it. And all the men weren't going to be bested, but the women, I was going to shoot them if they were. So they had to learn how to handle a jet ski in one day. Mark Travis is funny. He was riding a bicycle late one night. And there's a kind of a steep hill before you get to my parents' place. You come around a little bend that's got loose gravel. So old Mark, he's pedaling along that night. He'd been down to the bar where they had me on the satellite. And all the people sitting in there, Catholic priest for the area, was sitting in there watching me on TV. And Mark was pontificating about answering all the questions about this guy on TV. He's riding his bike home. We got worried about him. Got in the car and went looking for him. And Mark was just topping the rise. I'm going to get around to chapter 49 here. We're just topping the rise as you come down to turn the bend to come toward my parents' place where the gravel's kind of slick. And they turned the bend with bright lights on going up the hill. And Mark was riding in the middle of the road. And he was sure that they were going to run him down. And he just took off for the brush and impaled himself in manzanita brush. Just straight out into the brush. And he went into the brush so deeply that the bike was still standing up. And Mark Travis was just hanging there in the brush as they went to rescue him. But we went down to some German place one night to eat. And it was closed, so we went next door to what the... Only two of the tribes are under Roman dominion. That's Josephus, their historian, 1st century B.C. And who are the two tribes? Benjamin and Judah that comprise the southern kingdom. Now, they had returned from Babylon, rebuilt the second temple, rebuilt Jerusalem, and had become a kingdom with an Edomianite blended in, a descendant of Esau, Herod, ruling over them. When Jesus comes, and Josephus, a contemporary, is telling us clear into the first century A.D., those two only are under Roman rule. A vast multitude is outside. Second reference is Esdras. That they took counsel among themselves when they had opportunity to return to Palestine, decided they wouldn't do it, and for a year and a half, with much noise because of the multitude, passed through the headwaters of the Euphrates River that takes them through the Caucasus Mountains to a land north of the Black Sea, looking for a place they could practice their own laws, their own rules. Archaeology in the 1800s put the flesh on that bare bone. They had a different name. They were called Sakasuni or Saki. They were called Kumri, Kimri. And now archaeology in the south of Russia is finding artifact after artifact of people that trace their nation to the beginnings of the days of Jeroboam. Who then did these people become? They disappeared north of the Caucasus Mountains at the exact same time in history that the Celts appear. Again, it took the turn of the century into the 1800s for the 2,520-year period of discipline to pass, and the digs at Halstead and Latin for the first time opened up Celtic culture and broke the back of what German historians had laid on us in the 18th century, that the center of world history was Greco-Roman, and the culture of the Celts began to get the attention it deserved, and the Celtic people are born out of nowhere at exactly the same point in history that the Israelites, the house of Israel, the lost tribe, so to speak, disappeared, going through the Caucasus Mountains to hit exactly the same geographic area that the Celts mysteriously appear. Now, I've said it before, repeat it. There was either one hell of a collision, of which there's no record in history, or the Celts or Keltoi, as Herodotus, the Greek historian, said they called themselves, are none other than the exact same people under a new name. The lost tribes go through the Caucasus Mountains, north of the Black Sea, and settle in exactly the area that the Celts mysteriously appear. Now, I've been saying this for years. It is the historical thesis on which I've hung my research for more than 20 years. No one has been able to refute it. I've found no evidence anywhere to contradict it. And indeed, over the last 20 years, archaeology has pushed the Celts beyond their mysterious appearance north of the Black Sea and has traced them to no other place than south of the Caspian Sea, south of the Caucasus Mountains, right where the lost tribes were resettled when the Assyrians carried them into bondage. Now, if the Celts, as I believe, are the lost tribes, I'm not a British Israelite. That's a cult. That is a cultic carrying forward of the recognition in the mid-1800s of much evidence that the Celts concentrated in their final settlements in the area of the British Isles and Brittany have the characteristics of the lost tribes. A group of nuts took that truth and bent it out of shape and retrogressed into a kind of neo-legalism. And that is a cult, as the Pentecostals in Chile do not represent the concept of the Pentecostal experience in Acts 2 at large, nor do they have an identity with the Pentecostals of Europe and North America. But Celts are the lost tribes. That I'll hang my hat on and dare a refutation. And if it's true, without proving it for this moment, that's a hard-drawn cigar. You got to work with it. Tightly packed. That's too much work. I'm going to get myself a little Philippine cigar. You didn't know the Filipinos could make such good cigars, did you? You don't know what you'll learn on Sunday night TV. How many of you knew the Filipinos made good cigars? Not very many of you, did you? They've been making them for 200 years. They're not Celts. They're Proto-Malaysians. I have to work so hard with this one. God bless the Proto-Malaysians. Well, that's an interesting word. The lost tribes, the house of Israel, were the Proto-Celts. The Hebrews were the proto-house of Israel. The Hebrews were the proto-house of Judah. The Hebrews were proto to both the Israelite house of Israel, lost tribes, and the Jew. Understand the use of the term? Judah, the southern kingdom, before the name was attached, were the proto-Jews, as we now know them. The Jews of the captivity were the proto-Jew of the modern Jewish religion. When Zechariah and Haggai began to preach, they were questioned about certain holy days that were never introduced by Moses but added during the Babylonian captivity. So the Babylonian captivity Jews were proto to the modern Jewish religion. Therefore, the lost tribes could never be branches on that tree, because the lost tribes were not captives in Babylon. They therefore had no subsequent flow from the proto-Jewish religion that took its shape in Babylon. Hebrews were proto-house of Israel. House of Israel were proto-Celts. Follow that? Celts, proto-British Empire, proto-America. And from the Celts flowed most of the kingdoms of Northwest Europe. Now, if the Celts were the lost tribes, they then are the descendants of the birthright nation, the sons of Joseph. They were to become, not the Jew, the Celts. As the lost tribes under a new name, after the lost tribes made the trip through the headwaters of the Euphrates River, as 2 Esdras says, to settle north of the Black Sea, they became the recipients of the birthright. And when 2,520 years would run, with Manasseh first, because they were the first to be carried away, they carry and fulfill the promises. They are to become the fulfillment of the promise to Sarah and to Rebekah that out of them would come, and this is part of the birthright promise, multiplied kings existing at the same time. They were the people that were to become a community or commonwealth of nations, as was promised to Sarah. They were the people that were to become a mighty nation, that in concert, the 10,000s of Ephraim and the thousands of Manasseh would push the nations to the ends of the world and become an empire, colonializing, if you will, the world. They were the people that were to possess the gates of their enemies. And they ended up in Isles. Well, you shouldn't pass by verses like this. I'm at the 71st promise, all of which, as we've gone through these promises, deal upon what God had to say concerning these promised people. Listen, O Isles, unto me. Now, if the Celts become the fulfillers and recipients of promise, where do they end up? You know, I'd write in my Bible, "Listen, O British Isles, unto me." Makes sense, doesn't it? "And hearken, ye people from far." Now, if you believe God keeps his word, which is the basis of faith, who's your candidate? Tierra del Fuego? "Listen, O isles, unto me, and hearken, ye people from far. Thou art my servant, O Israel, in whom I will be glorified." You have to tell them, they don't know who they are. "I punished you 2,520 years. You may not know what's happening, but as he said in an earlier promise, he would sift them like grain through the nations, but not one would be lost. Listen, O isles, O British Isles. Hearken, ye people from far, clove there, United States. Thou art my servant, O Israel, in whom I will be glorified." That third verse is promise 72. That first verse is promise 71. "Listen, O isles, unto me, and hearken, ye people from far." That's promise 71. Verse 3, "Thou art my servant, O Israel, in whom I will be glorified." That's 72. "Then I said, I've labored in vain." Poor old Isaiah, he knew it. He didn't see any islands anywhere. "I spend my strength for naught and in vain. Yet surely my judgment is with the Lord, and my work with my God." His faith said, God's going to work it out. "And now, saith the Lord, that formed me from the womb to be a servant, to bring Jacob again to him, though Israel be not gathered, because they were in a scattered state, yet shall I be glorious in the eyes of the Lord, and my God shall be my strength. And he said," God speaking, "it is a light thing that thou shouldest be my servant to raise up the tribes of Jacob and to restore the preserved of Israel. I will also give thee for a light to the Gentiles, that thou mayest be my salvation unto the end of the earth." Now that's very personal to Isaiah. But put promise 73, starting at verse 5, and let me dissect it right on down through the 8th verse. Now, let's get something straight about Gentiles. The lost tribes were Gentiles. It's axiomatic. The lost tribes were Gentiles. Well, how can that be? Well, I'll tell you right after this. Rochester joined us in New York City, or Rochester in the state of New York. New York City is already with us. Bay City, Saginaw, Flint, now Escanaba, Green Bay, and Portland. Welcome. I made a statement before my face revolved. We're teaching on the lost tribes, who've never been lost to God, only lost to themselves and everybody else, and then for a time only. 2,520 years after that, the information is available to discover them. And I made a statement. You won't find the lost tribes until you recognize a simple fact. The lost tribes are Gentiles. They never were anything other than Gentiles. Goyim simply means people, but it became synonymous with non-Jew. Now, once you figure out who the Jew is, then anyone who is not a Jew is a Gentile. It's axiomatic. When you understand that Abram was not a Jew, he was a proto-Jew. The Jews came from Abram. Isaac was not a Jew. He was a Hebrew, as Abram was. Proto-Jew. Jacob was not a Jew. The Jew didn't come into being until the southern kingdom was formed. And the house of Israel, the northern kingdom, not being a Jew, was therefore Gentile. But he was a special kind of Gentile. A Gentile child of promise, a Gentile Hebrew, a Gentile descendant of Abraham, a Gentile recipient of the birthright. Gentiles fall into the heathen group outside the community of the elect, but also include those within the community of the elect that were not Jew. Got that? Now, who has been the greatest light to the Gentiles? Both the select Gentile, the house of Israel, and Gentiles in general. The door to the Gentile was opened by the suffering servant Messiah. It was Christ coming in the flesh, coming first to his own, the Jew, and his own received him not, that opened the door of grace. And it is Isaiah, more than any other prophet, that is the prophet of the suffering servant Messiah that gives the light to the Gentile. God sure kept his word. Even though poor old Isaiah is for a moment saying, I've spent my strength for naught. I'm in the 49th chapter of Isaiah, if you just joined us. Page 801, if you've got a Bible like mine. Thus saith the Lord, verse 7. I just threw that in to you that have been following me. The Redeemer of Israel and his Holy One, to him whom man despiseth, to him whom the nation abhorreth, to the servant of rulers, kings shall see and arise, princes also shall worship, because of the Lord that is faithful and the Holy One of Israel, and he shall choose thee. Does that happen? If the Celts are the lost tribes, and the lost tribes, dominated by Ephraim and Manasseh, become the recipient of the birthright, as 1 Chronicles 5 and Genesis 49 says. Out of them will come kings, scattered, appearing as not God's people, as Hosea 1 says. Nevertheless, they'll become a people as numerous as stars and sand, and will become known as the sons of God. Kings shall see and arise, princes also shall worship. Where'd that happen? Among the Celtic kings, the European community of kings, Christianized. The first Christian nation was the Silurian kingdom, converted by Joseph of Arimathea in Britain, never really conquered by the Romans. Verse 8, I'm still in Promise 73 from verse 5 on. Thus saith the Lord, in an acceptable time have I heard thee, and in a day of salvation have I helped thee, and I will preserve thee and give thee for a covenant of the people. To establish the earth, to cause to inherit the desolate heritages. One of the things that got me into stamp collecting was following the British colonial empire around. One of the areas I've specialized in is the loneliest outpost in the world, Tristan da Cunha, about halfway between the southern and western coast of Africa and the Falkland Islands, right in the middle of the South Atlantic. Most desolate place on earth, about the only thing that can grow is potatoes. Settled by the British. Last month or so, I reread about 4 books on Tristan da Cunha. Trying to figure out why would they go there? Cause to inherit the desolate heritages. What is that wanderlust that drove these people onward? I repeat, it's like that atheist in Britain said, God failed in his promise. All the things he promised to the Jew, he gave to the British Empire, which proves God can't keep his word. Well, we got to end it somewhere. Let's just end the 73rd promise with the 8th verse. and make the 74th promise start with the 9th verse. Because this whole chapter, that thou mayest say to the prisoners, go forth, to them that are in darkness, show yourselves. They shall feed in the ways, and their pasture shall be in all high places. They shall not hunger nor thirst, neither shall the heat nor sun smite them, for he that hath mercy on them shall lead them even by the springs of water, he shall guide them. What is this urge that drove the Americans from that little thin coast westward? What made them tackle in Conestoga wagons those trails across the west? I used to be work all of my college days up in Lassen Park, and I took my staff through Lassen Park, the old Pioneer Trail on the north side. What kept them going? And I will make all my mountains away, and my highways shall be exalted. Behold, these shall come from far, and lo, these from the north and from the west, these from the land of Sinem. Sing, O heavens, and be joyful, O earth, and bring forth into singing, O mountains. But Zion said, the Lord hath forsaken me, and my Lord hath forgotten me. God says, and this is the message to the lost tribes, can a woman forget her sucking child, that she should not have compassion on the son of her womb? Yea, they may forget, yea, yet will I not forget thee. Though a mother may forget her child, God will not. Behold, I have graven thee upon the palms of my hands. Thy walls are continually before me. Thy children shall make haste. Thy destroyers and they that made thee waste shall go forth of thee. Lift up thine eyes round about, behold, all these gather themselves together and come to thee. As I live, saith the Lord, thou shalt surely clothe thee with them all as with an ornament, and bind them on thee as a bride doeth. For thy waste and thy desolate places and the land of thy destruction shall even now be too narrow by reason of the inhabitants, and they that swallow thee up shall be far away. Now, all of that is simply saying God's not going to let them get lost. All of that is simply saying God's got them graven in his hand. All that is simply saying, if the lost tribes are lost, this whole chapter is a lie, and God can't keep his word. All this is saying that they're going to be somewhere far from those enemies that swallowed them up. Who are the enemies that swallowed them up? Assyria. Way back in the book of Samuel, God said to David when he was in the height of his power, furthermore, in addition to making your family a dynasty, until when you go out and see the sun come up every day and go out at night and see the moon and the stars, as long as you see those elements of nature, a descendant of David will be sitting on a throne of ruling over the children of Israel. Furthermore, he says, I'm going to make a new land grant. Just as I gave all this land here to the descendants of Abram, I'm going to give a new place, another place, to Israel. They'll go there, they'll stay there, and their former enemies will not trouble them anymore. The descendants of Esau, the descendants of Ishmael, the enemies that are the Canaanites, the Assyrians, the Syrians, the Medes, the Babylonians, the Persians, they won't bother them there. And he's saying the same thing. And in the place that they've settled, verse 19, shall even now be too narrow by reason of the inhabitants. It will become so populated that promise 75 is introduced in the 20th verse. The children which thou shalt have, I warn you. This is the lost tribes kingdom. Settle now in a place far away from their former enemies that swallowed them up. The children which thou shalt have, after thou hast lost the other child, shall say again in thine ears, the place is too straight or too narrow for me. Give place to me that I may dwell. After thou hast lost the other, your other children will say to you, Mom, I need space too. And what's the other one they lost? United States of America. The revolution of the late 1700s.